Hey everyone, Scott Stevenson here. My new book, Be Your Own Bodybuilding Coach, is out. You can get it at byobbcoach.com as well as Amazon and Barnes & Noble internationally.
Advices Radio Network.
The views and opinions of Muscle Minds is for entertainment and educational purposes only.
Gentlemen, we can rebuild him. We have the technology. We have the capability to make the world's first bionic man. Better than he was before. Better, stronger, faster.
Welcome to Muscle Minds with Dr. Scott Stevenson and Scott McNally, part of the Advices Radio Network, a new voice in bodybuilding podcasting.
Welcome back to Muscle Minds. I'm Scott McNally, and with me, as always, is Dr. Scott Stevenson. Scott, what is up, man? Great to hear from you.
It's Florida. It's finally cooling down, man. It's a nice, actually a cloudy day, which is very, very nice to have.
Is that kind of rare down there to have overcast?
For this long, yeah. Usually, there'll be a lot of times when it'll rain, like, every day for several days in a row, like, even weeks.
Yeah.
But it's been kind of like overcast and cool. We actually had a tornado Friday.
Wow.
Passed through. Yeah. And it rained pretty hard. But then it was sunny the next day. But wow. It's been like that really nice, cool, breezy, very, very pleasant weather.
Nice. It's cool here. I just got back from the NPC Western Michigan, which I got to tell you, Scott, it was a fantastic show. I think everybody waited this year to all get together and compete in that show. First of all,
everybody, all the good competitors,
all the good ones. Yeah, they all got the facts. They all got the memo to hold off until November. There were some good people. There was one kid in particular, and this kid's got some crazy genetics. He's there's no question in my mind. This kid is going to he's going to do really well. His legs were huge. Like, he had these crazy huge legs, you know, super lower body dominant. But you could see it, like, still fit together well. He won the overall in Classic. And like I said, it was his first show. I asked him about leg training, and he said he really hadn't trained legs consistently until he started prepping for the show.
Oh, geez.
Yeah, he's one of them.
Wow. Yeah. But he's in Classic, so he's not a mass monster as of yet.
No, not yet. But I could see him becoming one. Like, I could see it happening. But, I drove out there with all the leaves changing on Friday. And there were all sorts of bright yellows and reds and oranges, auburns of various tone. And then I woke up this morning to like a bitter cold November air, and a lot of the leaves are gone. Like, all the yellows are on the ground now. It's a lot more bare trees today.
Happened fast.
It did. But yeah. It was late though. Usually here, I keep note of when the leaves change, and usually we're about 2 weeks late. So we had a nice long fall. And now it's time to get ready for winter, get fat, and get in shape. Then again, I'll do it all again.
Buckle down to the annual cycle.
Yes, exactly. And so the next show I'll be at is going to be the Arnold Classic. I think it's going to be a little while.
Okay. Are all these competitors that were so good at the Western Michigan, are they gearing up for nationals?
You know, I only talked to a few of them. As far as what their plans were, I know I know a couple of them were. I think some of them just wanted to qualify just to do shows next year, you know, hit this one and then come back to Junior Nationals. Junior Nationals is really popular here since it's in Chicago. It's a 4.5 hour drive from us. So a lot of guys do Junior Nationals here. And I think that's what the plans are for some of them. I know the guy who did Classic wants to do the Arnold Classic. He said that's his goal. That's his dream, his dream competition to do next.
I just ask because that makes for a short off season, or even almost no off season. But if they had like the previous year off, and that was sort of their off season, and this is sort of their first show, and they're gonna have like a kind of a small period of off time, and then go, because Junior Nationals is in
June.
I was going to say it's in June. So it's definitely early. It's the earliest of the national level shows, I think.
Is it? I think Junior USA's is 2 weeks before.
Yeah, they've moved that around, I think. But yeah, those two are usually the first ones.
Yeah.
So that gives them a little time. You know, it gives them probably 2-3 months off.
Yeah.
Okay. Interesting. Is that show, was it extraordinary that the Western Michigan was so good?
It's traditionally been a big show, but okay. These last few shows, the Central States was very underwhelming. 2 weeks before that at the Powerhouse Classic, which it's not known to be a great show to begin with, it was almost non-existent. It was shocking how small the show was. So comparatively to what we have been seeing here in Michigan, it was great, but it was great even, you know, by the standards of any Michigan show. It was a good one, man. There were battles. It was a lot of fun. I made an adventure out of it. I went to go train at a gym called Maximus. I think it was Maximus Fitness or Maximus Gym. There's a bodybuilder out there that owns it. And get this. So the place I walked up to it, I was going to meet my client, and she was going to be my training partner, IFBB Pro Cara Trebish. She needs to work on some quad development. And through watching her videos and seeing how she trained, she was very like glute hamstring dominant in her training. And you could see it in her development too. So I wanted to get with her and work on kind of adjusting her stance and maybe stacking her exercises in such a way that we could work on the quads specifically and just kind of shift her focus. Because she's one of those girls that in the past she's even done like 3 leg workouts a week. And one of them's like all plyos and butt stuff. And then, you know, like the other two just kind of become hamstring work, you know. Right. So we're going to do 2 per week, one being hams and glutes, the other one being quad focused. And I think I gave her the tools for this. She woke up this morning. Her leg was sore exactly where we wanted it to be. So
nice.
That was good. But we got there. I got there first. I was going to meet her there. And the place, Scott, you would have loved this place. I'm driving through like a...
Look it up right now as we talk.
There's like a commercial park that I'm driving through. And then behind that, it comes out the side. And there's an old strip mall of storefronts. And every single one of them is empty. And the parking lot has holes in it, and there's like some sort of like cake decorating place where people don't even park in the parking lot to park there. They just pulled, like the owner just pulled like right up to the doors right next to the store and left his car parked there. And the other place is this Maximus Fitness or Maximus Gym. And all they had was like a cloth banner stretched across the front of the building that said the name of the shop. It looked like it was closed down.
What city? There's a bunch of them in Michigan that have Maximus in the name.
Oh, really? Near Grand Rapids. It may not have been in the city proper. I'm not sure. It might have been in a surrounding suburb, but that should bring it up.
There's 2 of them there. Okay.
Okay. Well, I got in. This kid walked over. The door is locked. Okay. And yeah. I'm like, oh, they closed. And I see people in there. And it was one of the gyms with like a 24-hour swipe pass thing. Sure. And they were supposed to be staffed, but... I think everybody was at the show. The owner was at the show. Several people from the gym were at the show. And so I think they just locked the place up. And some kid walked over. He let me in. I'm like, oh, shit. I don't even know if I should train here. And then Cara showed up. So I let Cara in. And then I got a hold of the owner. I found him on Instagram and I messaged him. I said, hey, I'm standing in your gym right now. I'm here to see the Western. I would love to get a workout in, but I would also love to pay you. How can we do this? And he told me, he said, just go, you know, back and put $10 under the keyboard at the register. It's like, okay. So that's what we did. And we had a great workout, man. It was a lot of fun.
I've done that before at gyms. I've literally the same exact thing where I've actually gotten into gyms before when there was like literally no one there to take the money. And I just left a $20 bill.
Yeah.
Yeah. Cause I figured they probably could use it, but, that's awesome, man. I'm trying to see pictures of the gym right now. I'm looking it up. Hopefully there'll be like a street level view.
They had some decent equipment too. I mean, some of it was kind of old and some of it was kind of beat up, but they had some stuff that just, it felt really good. And And although maybe some things were a little bit like rusty, a little bit hard to adjust to you know, get the leg pad where you wanted it for extensions or whatever, we made it work and it felt really good. And we had a really, like I said, we both had pretty good workouts. And it was one of those fun, unplanned type days where you just, I left town with an adventure in mind and I ended up meeting a bunch of people, met a bunch of listeners, and had just an overall great time. Got to support a couple clients. They both were first time competitors. They were, you know, thrilled beyond belief with the experience. They both did well too. And it was cool, man. It's
awesome.
In part, what bodybuilding is about to me is, mm-hmm. you know, the contest and that day of really celebrating all that hard work. It had all those things, you know, all those things just wrapped up into the final show of the season, man. It was a fitting end, put it that way.
That's phenomenal, dude. But you're on your stomping grounds too. So, you know, people.
And
you know where you're going, you feel comfortable, so that's phenomenal.
Yeah, very well done. Remy Berminga, the show promoter, did hell of a job. He puts care into the shows, which makes a difference. So I appreciated being able to come out and, you know, hang out backstage and, you know, talk to a bunch of people. So it was cool, man. But I'm back now. I literally just got home. Got off the road an hour or so ago, and now we plugged in here. You just got back not too long ago. You were in Swiss, right? You were at the Swiss meetings, right? Up in Canada.
Yeah, Society of Weight Training and Injuries, or Weight Training and Injury Specialists.
How did that go, man?
It was good. It was fun. John Meadows and I did a talk that was fun. It basically kind of tips and tricks for staying in the game as long as you can. So
nice.
Yeah, we formulated our about half an hour for each of us, roughly.
Okay.
And it ended up till about three quarters of what we came up with was similar, you know, which is fine, you know, which is really important. You know, there's a ton of talks in there, a massive amount of information.
Yeah.
And I'm always reminded, and maybe someone who's listening to this, because I know I talked to some listeners when I was up there, will think back now on what they said if they saw me speak, that if you even think about the best class you took in college, or like one of your most memorable courses or lectures or instructors, professors, what have you, like how many things can you literally remember specifically from those interactions or those talks? And it's usually like just a few. You know, if you get like one or two gems that you could take with you long term that really stick and influence your thinking, you know, in at least a conscious way, that's gigantic. So I told him, like, hey, you know, what John's going to say, we came with this independently, and then I saw what he had to say, but I didn't want to try to say different things. It's important to reiterate the same message again and again. That's the hallmark of basically learning things, is you have to remember them if you've learned them. And that comes from repetition. So hopefully I'll say things a little bit differently than John.
Absolutely.
Yeah, and I'd go through, and this is what I do when I teach my classes too. I'd say, okay, I'm about to repeat something intentionally. So remember when I said this in this context? I'm saying the same thing here again in this context. And so remember when John said this about doing this? This is why I'm saying this. I'm saying the same thing that he just said. So see that connection. I want you to fuse that information, that memory, with what you're getting now, and coalesce that into one thought.
I like
the one you can take with you.
I like that you were able to recognize that you were doing it, and that you, because I think sometimes people will reiterate just because it is an important thought. But by stopping and saying that, I think you grab people's attention, because sometimes it would be very easy, because you got to think too, in our podcasts, you know, a lot of things that everybody says are repetitive, you know.
Of course, yeah.
The answers you may give in a situation might be similar to what Skip may give on another program, or, you know, something similar to that VJ or I may say on Bodybuilding Nerds, or a guest might say Jose Raymond or Dusty Henshaw. You know, we do that Huge as Fuck program, and it's basically about how to get huge. And what are the basic answers? How to get big. You eat and you train hard, you know, and that's basically the beginning and the end. But you hear somebody say it multiple times from different perspectives, and yeah, it can sink in better. But because you were able to say, hey, pay attention to this, I'm going to say it again, but in a slightly different way, you connect. Because it would be easy to say, oh, I already heard this, and just shut off.
Oh, of course. It just floats in one ear and out the other.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Yeah.
Almost because the thought, in a certain way, like, oh, I've already heard this.
Yeah.
And so it's like you've already seen something, so your attention is not called to that notion unless I plant a flag and say, hey, we're saying this for a second time, or I'm going to say this for the third time after John said it twice already because it's an important one. So I want you to make sure you do some processing with this, because processing is like one of the things. Actually, someone at the Olympia asked me this because he'd heard me talk about various things related to academia. And I was the academic dean at the acupuncture school for a few years, one of the Beck in Arizona. And I literally taught a class. It was kind of a one-on-one lecture that I gave to several students on like methods of learning and ways of learning. And because there's students who just weren't naturally adept at picking up information. They're bright in their own way. They just hadn't figured out their own learning style. And one of the most important points that I would tell them is figure out how and why it is that you learn certain things and not other things. What's your learning style? Do you hear them? Do you need to see them? Do you need to write them? Do you need to teach them? And I would have people figure out those and then use as many of those repetitively as possible. So literally I'd have people make cheat sheets. Like it's not that they're going to use the cheat sheets, but try to consolidate like an entire test worth of information onto 8.5 by 11 sheet. Yeah. And then rewrite that and then go and teach that to my dogs they're brilliant because they've gone through so many lectures, with me with me teaching things. And, so anyway, the idea there was to try to get people to, process something again, because that's one of the best ways to make sure that it sticks.
Yeah.
You have to have processed it, for you to learn it.
Yeah. No question. I think that's great, man. So overall it was, how was the steroid panel?
Yeah. And actually you kind of gave me a segue to the steroid panel, because I actually reiterated the same thing on like at least two or three of my comments. So it was a different number, different. There wasn't the same people as a couple of years ago. It was 2 years ago when we did the last one. So we didn't have Dorian. We didn't have Bill Kazmaier. Ben Johnson wasn't on the panel. Some of the same players. Eric Serrano was on there. Darren Willoughby was on there. Rick Collins was there. I was there. John sat next to me. Yeah. Christian Thibodeau was on the panel. Victoria Felfar was on there again. Yeah.
Yeah. How was she?
Oh, she's as outspoken as always.
Yeah. You know, yeah.
Just lays on the line.
Yeah.
Just throws people shit right in people's faces. Mm-hmm. And, in a way that's blunt, to the point, articulate, and jam packed with information.
I would expect nothing less of her.
Yeah. Yeah. So yeah, she hits people in a way. Actually, I have the sense that I may have done that too.
Really?
Style. Well, just sometimes you get a little bit of applause, you get some thoughts, and you express something and people will kind of there's a lot of applause after someone would make a comment.
Okay.
And I heard from a lot of people afterwards, they really liked what I had to say. But I think I left some people somewhat kind of almost dumbfounded. And Victoria has the tendency to do that. She hits you with something sort of that's profound. And people don't even know quite what to do. It's like, they're like, whoa, that was pretty, pretty wickedly deep.
Yeah.
And it's just kind of like, ugh. So the thing that happened that was different this year, one of the main themes that I've talked to a couple of people about this, just of course the conversation, who asked me about the thing, about the whole trip, is last time we were talking about more so about legalities and the nature of incorporation of steroids and PEDs and sport and what people really want. We talked about the Mark McGuire episodes and sort of more of a historical perspective on things. And this time, because of the panelist composition, we talked more about the fact, and Victoria brought this up in one of her formal lectures, and she mentioned again on the panel that there's so many young people who are getting into the physique sports, either competitors or not,
sure,
who are using massive amounts of gear.
Yeah.
And coaches are having them do this. And it got to be, it almost people were saying the same thing over and over again, because it's a really important message that, that really needs to be addressed. But it was, it sort of started coming off with a negative overtone. At least that's what I kind of sensed. In a way that it was saying, there, here's the problem. But it was almost in a scolding type of way. Like, this is just asinine and silly and stupid and ignorant and unnecessary and like unbelievable. And and of course, when it comes to making change and affecting behavioral change and getting people to, quote unquote, see the error in their ways or gain perspective on what they're doing, telling someone like, don't be a fucking idiot, for instance, like just like blast them with negativity in that sense, doesn't really serve that purpose. That's not that's not an, like, you don't like go up to someone who's, you know, overweight and out of shape and say, hey, quit being a slob and get in the gym. Like, that doesn't work.
No, no.
You know, and not even close. And no one was, no one was directly saying that in the least. So don't get me wrong. No one was, you know, literally trying to like berate and, you know, call anyone stupid or anything negative in that way. It was just like this, everyone was sort of flabbergasted. And the, so the point that I made a couple times, at least maybe even three times, was the thing that we're missing now that we're going to have to incorporate into this discussion and our perspective on this is some empathy with the people that we're talking about, the young people talking about, who are being exposed online to social media, where you've got so many basically perfect bodies that are forming what we sort of perceive as being average and normal. The standard of body image is becoming even more warped from what's reasonable, and it's continuously warped. And of course, you don't see people when they get out of shape in their off season or what have you, because, you know, people will just repeatedly post the pictures that where they look the best, or they'll take 50 selfies to get the one that's idealized. So we have to recognize that that's like that aspect of things. Coaches going bonkers with, like Victoria mentioned, I can't remember exactly what it was that, that she had heard recently from a bikini competitor whose coach, a bikini competitor whose coach had her on 9 different things, including testosterone, trenbolone, halotestin.
Bikini.
Bikini, yeah. I think Winstrol and Deca, and then both Novodex and Letrozole.
Wow.
Yeah, and there's, I'm missing a couple, but they were like, I was like, oh my God.
And the thing is, too, this poor girl who hasn't done any research on her own, I'm sure, is just doing what she thinks she's supposed to do. This is what she believes is the way it's supposed to be, because that's what she's being told by somebody.
And the thing that I mentioned, I did the, my little, I explained my thought experiment here ad nauseum on the podcast about, imagine, you know, if you're a time traveler, you could go back in time and recreate, you know, who you would become were you born 20 years earlier. I kind of reiterated that. I'm like I was a knucklehead 20 years ago. I can't say that I wouldn't be doing things a lot differently than I did had I been born in the time and age where you've got coaches saying it's okay to, you know, take massive amounts of steroids
right
off the bat, and, you know, and everyone's, and you're exposed, your brain and wiring is being changed by what you see on your phone in the palm of your hand continuously. Things are just absolutely utterly different in a way that it's literally, it's, hopefully we can identify with in some way, shape or form.
Yeah,
that's what I tried to do, but empathizing, we just can't do it, because you know, the people that we're talking about who are maybe in their mid 20s or what have you, millennials or in and about that that generation, have grown up with the wiring of their social wiring being totally different than what like yours and mine is. Some people resist it and end up, you know, being a little bit different. But it's like with system we have to recognize. It's not that those people are weaker. Like this is a natural human tendency, is to look at someone who's doing something that you reject or you don't think is appropriate, and to somehow disidentify yourself from them and see them as being maybe somehow inferior or substantially different or other than you. We don't do that for family members. I always use the grandmother. I think I did this on the last podcast. Imagine, like, you've got a grandmother who you love, who's just a horrible driver. You give her so much more patience, you know, if she's driving, you know, than you if you maybe you're following her, than if it's someone you don't know, you know. So we see all these people we don't know, and we have such little patience for them, and that's not going to solve the problem.
Right.
So I brought that up a couple times in the course of the panel discussion.
Did anybody have any kind of responses to that?
That was no. It was kind of like crickets almost. I know it wasn't like horrible. I heard, you know who Stuart McGill is?
I've heard the name, but yeah, I don't know who he is.
Phenomenal guy. Many people know who he is. He's sort of a expert in biomechanics and physical therapy, and he's worked with a lot of really high-level powerlifters and power and strength athletes.
Hmm.
And he's, you know, an expert on biomechanics of the spine. He's written several books. And he's been a speaker up there for years and years and years. He's just very, very is a brilliant guy and really well spoken. And he and I chatted a bit afterwards, and he said he really enjoyed my commentary, which
nice.
Meant a lot. Yeah. So he wasn't saying it to be nice. He was saying it, I think, because he honestly thought that was the case, and he shared the perspective.
Yeah.
So it's sort of one of those things. It's like, whoa, this is kind of hard. It's a really hard thing to do.
Yeah.
But I think it makes logical sense. You just, anyone who's a human behaviorist or a psychologist or even an armchair psychologist realizes that if you really care about someone, if you really care about others and you want to try to get them to do what's right for them, you have to meet them where they are in some way, shape, or form.
Yeah.
And telling them like what you're doing is stupid. I mean, that might be okay at some point in time for children. You know, I'm not a parent and I'm not an expert on, you know, parenting, but sometimes you just got to tell kids like that's just an absolute no-no.
Right.
But we're talking about people now that are in their 20s who've, you know, their prefrontal cortices are pretty close to being fully formed. They should be able to make their own decisions. But all what's gone into how they make those decisions is totally different, not totally, but substantially different, obviously, from us. And it's leading to them doing things that are going to be really potentially harmful to them. Not that they don't have the choice to do that, but I think like this bikini competitor, if she really knew the ramifications of doing all that stuff, she would have balked at it. You just can't imagine. And she was concerned, but she just didn't know. What you said was dead on. So it's just a matter of ignorance.
Yeah.
It's clouded over by a perspective that's been developed through social media and talking to people who are likewise ignorant in certain ways. So anyway, we'll see what happens. It's, you know, who knows? I wonder how things will be 10 years from now.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I've been wanting to get Rick Collins on one of the shows. I haven't decided what I'd specifically like to talk to him about, but he's such a brilliant guy and I haven't heard him on any podcasts in a while.
I talk with Rick a few times. I sat next to him during dinner or pretty close to him, and we chatted in the hall. He's been around for a long time. He was a bodybuilder competitor for years.
I heard that. Yeah. Which obviously gives him the foundation for his interest in, you know, working with a lot of things related to bodybuilding in his career.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. We chatted about that. One of the days we ran into each other in the hallway and chatted for about half an hour, I think.
Nice.
And then I could probably convince Rick to come on.
All right. Yeah. That's we'll have to talk to him and that'd be great. What do you say? We take a quick break and come back and knock out some questions.
Let's do it.
All right, guys, we'll be right back. If you've enjoyed Scott Stevenson's contribution to Muscle Minds, you can learn more about him, his products, and his services at fortitudetraining.net. And if you order any of his products or services, you get a free subscription to his message board where he answers questions daily. Go to fortitudetraining.net to learn more about all these products, services, and events offered by Scott Stevenson. Hey guys, Scott McNally here.
And this is VJ Peary.
You guys know us from here at the Advices Radio Network,
Well, we also have another show, Bodybuilding Nerds Radio. We've got everything from supplement reviews
to shout outs,
listener questions,
and of course, our weekly bodybuilding podcast reviews.
So check us out every Friday.
Or whenever you feel like cooking or doing your cardio or basically wasting time with us.
You can hear us at bodybuildingnerds.com.
Also on iTunes. Bodybuilding Nerds, it's time to get nerdy.
All right, guys, and welcome back to the show, Muscle Minds with Dr. Scott Stevenson. I'm Scott McNally. We're going to go back to, let's see, who is this guy? All right, and this is from Jeff over on the message board. Guys, if you want to submit any questions, go to forum.advicesradio.com, and in the bodybuilding section, there are stickies at the top for all the shows, including Muscle Minds. You can post there, and we are slowly but surely getting through all the questions. Thanks for everybody who has submitted questions. And Jeff had asked us a few other things. Yeah, he had asked us about like life lessons and implementing change to overcome those things in our lives previously, as well as a couple other cool stuff. He was the one who suggested we talked about like philosophical topics in the last episode. So right. His final question, he says, this is a little more direct. He's got something a little more tangible to talk about. He says, could you sometime talk a little about androgens and the brain? I've read some studies that suggest physiological doses of test are neuroprotective, but also have seen studies which suggest lesser gray matter volume in AAS users, impaired dopamine and serotonin receptors, and decreased levels of neuropeptide Y. Just wondering what the big picture is on androgens and brain health. This is something I know nothing about, Scott, so I'm really interested to hear what you have.
Oh, there's a gigantic body of literature on this. It's somewhat... of course, you can't do direct studies. You can't do, you know, at least not with heavy, high doses of gear. You're not going to be able to, like, let's see how adverse the effects on brain neuroanatomy or neurotransmitter letters are, levels are, or psychological effects and those sorts of things. You've got to just sort of piece it together. But one of the things he sort of points to is that being hypogonadal, low testosterone, is definitely not a positive thing. Okay. There's a pretty intimate connection between, for instance, depression and low testosterone. So as to which causes which, whether the hypogonadism causes the depression or the depression is then reflected in hormonal imbalances in low testosterone, is kind of hard to tease out. But clinically, I don't think too many clinicians who do HRT are gonna argue, because when you replace the testosterone, things change dramatically. Yeah. Cognitive function comes back. People feel better. The depression is lifted. The fog is gone. There's so many positive psychological benefits just from, you know, getting out of you can go and Matt Porter, of course, did his experiment. It's a couple of years old now, where he decided, like, no more high level doses. I'm gonna, you know, completely come off. And his testosterone levels were they were in like the double digits, something like that. They were horrible. Okay. And he felt awful. He looked awful. Hmm. I mean, I don't mean that in a disparaging way. He just looked like how he said he felt, like not very happy. So I think the question, though, mainly is kind of focusing on what do we know about gear, high levels of gear, super physiological levels. There have been, there's so much on this. There have been studies, for instance, suggesting a correlation between aggression and testosterone in like prisoners. But we also know that if you undergo they've even done the sorts of things with like video games. If you have some sort of victorious experience or positive psychological experience, it will be reflected in your androgen levels and even cortisol levels, of course, too. So testosterone levels will go down. They tend to be lower. Like if someone has lost a competition, you sample the the losers of like a big soccer game or something like that. I can't remember the exact studies, but you tend to find they'll be lower than the winners and be reduced. Yeah. Testosterone levels go down after marriage as well, too.
I've heard that. I've heard that usually in jokes, you know.
No, but there's the data support that idea. So there's a psychological component, you know, there where one's life experiences are reflected in the hormones. I mean, it could be like if you think about the prisoners, like what's causing what? Are the prisoners who are more aggressive, and because they're more aggressive and they can continue, they're successful being more aggressive, meaning they're not getting their ass whooped every time they try to be aggressive. Well, then they're having repeated wins, so to speak, in the prison, and then that would tend to elevate their testosterone if it's the outcome of their life situation or their experience that drives the hormonal response.
Yeah.
It could be the other way around. It's probably a little both. It's probably an interwoven type of scenario there. So that's like a really, it's a pretty fascinating and actually somewhat obviously politicized topic, this whole idea of like roid rage.
Yeah.
You know, that's there's a lot of variability, as you know, with how guys experience different types of gear. Some people will, you know, the old analogy, like it just sort of amplifies your personality. There's probably some truth to that.
I can see that. Yeah.
Yeah. And it's impossible to tease these things out. The scenario I always think about is imagine someone, if you could just somehow do a controlled study. I'm thinking about the kind of the roid rage or gear making someone changing their personality, so to speak. So you take someone who's got maybe a bit of a Napoleon complex. They got poor self-esteem. They think a little of themselves, and maybe they've got some aggressive tendencies. And then you give that person an extra 40 pounds of muscle mass, which allows them to feel more confident. Because they have that muscle mass, they like how they look. They can sort of scare and intimidate people, and they have basically a suit of armor that they're now walking around in.
Yeah, which I think that's real common for guys too.
Well, that in and of itself, regardless of whatever hormonal or steroidal effects brought that about, just being bigger and more muscular and looking that way would affect how that person engages as they go through life.
Yeah,
it's kind of like, you know, you give someone a gun or they don't have a gun. They're going to behave totally different in the situation depending on whether they have the gun. Can they protect themselves? Can they not? Are they safe? Are they not safe? You know, you don't have the gun, you run. You know, you have a gun, you stand and you make it known and you do what you need to do with the gun.
Yeah.
So then there's, of course, the effect, like what do the steroids actually do to someone? And that seems to be really highly variable. Everything from sex drive, aggression, you know, how it changes a person's interaction with others. And I was just talking with someone not too long ago, and she was relating to me a interaction with someone who she had, a competitor who probably was off, and then he was on. And he was doing things that he seemed like he never would have done in weeks previous. And then he started getting ready for a show, and all of a sudden it's like this absolute flip-flop.
Yeah.
He's someone who just, you know, was highly variable. So that's like kind of some background information. It's hard to kind of – there's so much variability here, just like there's so much variability as to how well people respond to gear. You know, and that has to do with things we talked about before on the show, like the phosphodiesterase 7B enzyme that cleaves the fatty acid from esterified injectables, and the CAG repeats in the androgen receptor that determine affinity for androgens.
Hmm.
It predicts prostate cancer and those sorts of things too. Actually, that's predictive of the effect to which testosterone replacement impacts depression. There's actually a study, it's cited in my book, pretty sure, demonstrating that when they look at indices of depression and with HRT in men, depends on, there's a genetic component there as to how well they respond.
Wow. Yeah. What do you mean by how well they respond? How does that really, I'm sorry, can you just explain that a little further? Because I don't know if you're saying that it helps with depression or people with low testosterone get depression or.
So generally you'll find that if people with, there's depression is associated with hypogonadism, low testosterone. And then depression is relieved when you provide the HRT.
Yeah.
And but that's variable. Some people have a greater effect than others.
Oh, I see. I see.
And some of that is dependent upon, there's a correlation between the number of CAG repeats that you have, which changes the shape of the androgen receptor and how responsive the cells are in the brain and muscle and wherever there's an androgen receptor. There's only one androgen receptor gene. Wherever there's an androgen receptor, how the sensitivity to testosterone is dependent upon the shape of that receptor.
Okay.
So some people are going to be more sensitive to testosterone. So if someone's somewhat, I mean, there's actually androgen insensitivity syndrome where people just, I mean, those will be people who will have like a phenotype of a woman. They will have, cryptorchidism and microphallus and basically, or literally like no, they will look like a woman, as far as external genitalia go.
Wow.
But they'll be XY. Huh. They just are completely insensitive to androgens. So all the effects of androgens on sexual dimorphism and sexual development of all the secondary, the primary and the secondary sexual characteristics.
Yeah.
So whether or not there's a penis is a primary.
Yeah.
Secondary would be, you know, like facial hair and things like that. Like they miss out on all of that. So genetically the person's a male, but from a gender perspective, they would be called a woman.
So by like you could probably have that person on like 2 grams of the test and they probably wouldn't get anything out of it.
Nothing. You know? Wow. They get nothing. Yeah. And they've done research looking at some of that. There's, you know, trying to figure out how to, you know, what's going on with that sort of situation. So
okay. I just found that interesting. And I'd be curious. You know, I know so many people that have taken antidepressants in their lives, and I could see where a doctor could correlate that. Yeah. You know, you're having a tough time, you know, these issues in your life, this obviously you're depressed and I'm going to put you in antidepressant. And maybe there's situations where it makes total sense that, you know, that this is depression. It's that they make sense that it's not test related, but I think I don't know anybody, I think, who's gone to their psychologist about depression and that they said, well, let's run your testosterone.
I've talked to some people who, but usually I know that because I brought the topic up and sometimes they follow it up because I mentioned it.
Okay.
I
can tell you that, It definitely has affected my mood in a positive way. I didn't have my test levels checked before I had ever used gear. And so after I began using it, my levels had never been high, even in recovery and in a recovered state. But I could say though that, I definitely believe that a lot of mood issues I had when I was younger were related to low testosterone. I could tell you it's like a night and day difference. And I had tried antidepressants and stuff when I was a teenager, and none of them really fit the bill for helping me, unlike testosterone, which just kind of totally balanced me right out.
Huh. So you think you were lately sort of borderline hypogonadal when you're younger?
Possibly, yeah.
Yeah. Okay. So you don't have any like direct measurements of that, but you know that the standard, you know, run of the mill antidepressants didn't do the trick for you, but testosterone seemed to have.
Yeah. Yeah. So yeah, that it made a huge difference. It made a huge difference in my life. And it's something that no doctor had ever even suggested looking into.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, the doctors, that's a whole other topic, but there are good ones and there are bad ones. And there are a lot of them that, you know, their training is just basically made them, really good at selecting out the standard drug protocols that they're taught.
Yeah.
And not thinking in an integrative way and in a global way and you know, and understanding the deeper neuroendocrinology, especially because it's hard to test. Like, I mean, gosh, you look in the PDR, physician's desk reference, at like different drugs and like so many of like, I mean, we know like serotonin reuptake inhibitors have that effect, but there's also all sorts of other effects of drugs, for instance.
Yeah.
And they, a lot of times there's not, like, you look at the effects of a particular drug that's an antidepressant and it's affecting multiple neurotransmitter systems all simultaneously. We don't know which ones are most or lesser important for the effects. And sometimes they do and sometimes they don't work. And some of it's just placebo effect too. You can have placebos work really, really well. In fact, they're running into problems now over the years because placebos have been getting better and better in drug trials with antidepressants. And the thought, at least this is what I read, someone speculated in the literature, is because people are now becoming more aware of antidepressants. You see, I don't have a television, but I can't, like, if I go like watch the Super Bowl or something like that, there's always like an antidepressant commercial on there.
Right.
Always. So people are recognizing that antidepressants are antidepressants, like that they're supposed to treat depression.
Right.
So they're coming to believe that and develop the psychological expectancy of such.
Yeah.
So go into a drug trial and you know you're given something that could be an antidepressant. You know there's placebo there, but you're expecting that you could have an antidepressant effect, and you do. So the placebos work really, really well, and they're working better and better because more people are believing them. So now it's questioning of like, so are these things are messing with their brain chemistry, but how much of is placebo and how much of it is actually neuropharmacology?
Yeah, I can see that would get blurry real quick.
Yeah, especially because you can also like give, I can't say that I can remember specifically a study. I'm almost positive it's been done. I have to go and dig and look, but I can't remember if someone's actually done a study where they, probably for ethical reasons, but you could probably start someone out on a real antidepressant, tell them it's antidepressant, create the expectancy, start them out on it, and then switch them to a placebo. I'm sure there's been some crossover studies that have done. Maybe someone can look it up, or I'll look it up after we're done. But I would imagine you can probably just maintain the antidepressant effect on a placebo as well as on the drug itself, and probably avoid some of the side effects and things that come from coming off.
Yeah.
But there's a whole lot more to this idea. I wrote a bunch of things down. There's a big section in my book on side effects. And like one of the things he mentioned, you do see when you're looking at steroid users, when they've imaged the brain, a thinning of the gray matter.
That can't be good.
No, that's not because, the gray matter is where the cell bodies are. So that means fewer neurons. That suggests neuronal death.
Mm.
Also reduced volume of the white matter. So that's where the axons are projecting. So you've got both the neurons themselves and the axons projecting that sort of represent the interconnectedness and the complexity of the neuronal activity that your brain can manage. And if you're losing both of those, those is a good thing. They also see, there's this one study, and maybe Dave Crossland, we talked about it in person. We might have mentioned on the show when he was on here, where they found that steroid users have an enlarged amygdala.
Mm.
And maybe because, maybe they had enlarged amygdala and they started using steroids to compensate. Or, what that means in terms of their tendency to be more fearful and or aggressive. So, the steroids were like, a kind of a protective mechanism. Or it could be that the steroids, because they can tend to increase aggressiveness, may do that. That may be mediated in part through the amygdala. So you're basically, producing some growth of that brain region. The brain structure by using the steroids. I can't say which, but it's associated. I haven't seen where they've like put people on and off, or they looked at, I don't think the study looked at like previous steroid users to see if it shrunk back down, so to speak.
Yeah.
There's lost some visual spatial memory impairment. So like remembering patterns and those sorts of things, like that would be like a kind of like reading maps and remembering directions, that sort of thing tends to be reduced. Animals have, when they give animals steroids, it impairs maze running ability. So that's visual spatial. They can run them through a maze. There's food at the end of the maze. And of course they make all sorts of wrong turns before they finally find their way out. And then they put them back in the maze and you can see how fast they run the maze the next time through. Mm. So the learning is evaluated by their ability to shorten their time through the maze from the beginning to the end. And a lot of that is mediated through the hippocampus. And those cells seem to be pretty sensitive to steroids. The steroids they're neurotoxic. So they cause apoptosis. They something about the cellular mechanisms when you bind to the androgen receptor, it triggers some of the apoptotic enzymes like caspases, and which is also a degradative. It's a proteolytic enzyme, and so the neurons will degenerate. So you tend to kill off neurons, particularly in this hippocampus area. There's another study with trenbolone that's floated around recently. You may have mentioned it, where they found that like just a few days of what was equivalent to a dose of tren that people would typically use showed a significant increase in beta amyloid plaque in the brain of rats. I think it was rodents, either rats or mice. So beta amyloid plaque is the hallmark of Alzheimer's disease.
Wow.
Yeah. So that's not good. It's excitotoxic, causes cell membrane death, causes visual spatial memory losses in animals, increases beta plaque. So it's like we're talking about short term memory. We're talking about, you know, aspects of potential senile dementia. That's the interesting thing, is that we're talking about, I'm not sure how much this would happen if you just used testosterone, but different drugs do different things.
True.
In which the androgen binds to the androgen receptor changes its effects on the cell. You know, the simplest way to look at this is androgenic versus anabolic actions. And as we talked about before, like some of the orals have like really, really poor binding affinity. Like they have hardly any binding affinity to the androgen receptor.
Yeah, like Anadrol, I remember you were saying, was one of them.
Yeah, they bind really poorly. But if you give enough of them, other studies show that there is activity of androgen receptor element transcription factors. So you still turn on the genes that are regulated by the androgen receptor and androgens, but something's going on differently in terms of how that's being mediated. So the problem might not be just, you know, the extent to which testosterone, or maybe, you know, dihydrotestosterone. So there's also genetics of how much you 5-alpha reduce testosterone and make DHT. A lot of that's tissue specific. I don't even know what happens in the brain as far as 5-alpha reductase. That may be region specific. I've not found that information, but you know, we get the side effects of hair loss and acne and prostatic hypertrophy because of 5-alpha reductase activity in those tissues. They tend to make more DHT, and that's why you get those tissue specific side effects.
Okay.
Who knows? It could be that there's 5-alpha reductase variations in the brain. That data may be out there. I don't know. I haven't uncovered it. Mm. But anyway, so we got these drugs that are working outside of the normal endogenous androgen metabolism. These aren't like, you know, androstenedione or some of the other androgens that are endogenous, or the main one, testosterone or DHT. These are binding to the androgen receptor or not binding, and they're turning on these genes in a non-physiological, pharmacological way that seems to have an excitotoxin effect, an apoptotic effect, the beta amyloid plaque issue. There's all sorts of redox issues. So there's some free radical production that seems to be involved with some of this when they look at the cells in culture. They've done some addiction types of things as well in animals, and there seems to be differential effects there. So as far as how and where they're binding in the reward centers of the brain. Mm-hmm. So anyway, there's some interesting differences. Not a lot of it's been obviously borne out, because you just can't, like, it's like, it's, it'd be like saying, especially with today's political climate, be like saying, like, okay, let's just see how addictive cocaine is. Let's put one group of cocaine in, and like, let's see how badly it fucks them up.
It was kind of like that study you said we couldn't do, like, what was it? It was like, how bad is it to warm up or not warm up before you get into your heavy set? You know, you just can't do these things.
Right. Like, okay, your PR today would be a 500-pound squat. We're going right to that.
Right.
You get no warm up, you got no warm up sets.
Right. Just unethical.
Like, yeah, pretty much. Those are some bits and pieces that don't, you know, speak too highly, but a lot of variability. It's like any drugs. Like, some people can do really well. They metabolize drugs really well, and they do really well with them psychologically. You know, like, I think I mentioned my grandma, my mom's mom lived to be in her late 90s, and she was eating 100 aspirin a week.
Oh my God.
The last 30 years of her life or something like that for rheumatoid arthritis. Never had a GI problem, her stomach was fine. Just like nothing. You know, like, she went to the doctor, and like, he asked her at one point, like, because when she was in her 90s, she was a little cantankerous, and he said, so what are you doing for your pain right now? And she's like, I'm eating aspirin like it's candy. He's like, how much aspirin have? She's like, about 100 a week, about a bottle a week, I guess. He's like, you can't do that. And she's like, well, what are you doing for me? And he didn't really have a good answer. And she's like, and she was fine with it.
Yeah.
Just an iron gut, you know? So that isn't a reason, you know, why you should, if you don't experience side effects, or you can just bottle them down, that you should just blast through a potentially, like, really, really highly toxic cycle.
Yeah.
It's not a reason to not look at your, you know, do blood work and measure your health parameters. So that's the thing about a lot of this stuff is, you're not probably going to know.
Yeah.
You know, if you're killing off, it's a long, slow, progressive thing. If you're killing off neurons, you know, we've got there's a reserve of those, more than likely. And it's not like all of a sudden, you know, steroids are just going to make you stupid in like a week.
Right. Right.
But they could make you really, I mean, if you're susceptible to that, they could really affect your mood and your sex drive.
Yeah.
We know that from women. I mean, that's one of the things that, you know, from a experimental model standpoint, like from a scientific standpoint, women are relatively deficient in androgens compared to men.
Yeah.
So like that's a great way to test the effectiveness of anything, is when you can have, in scientific terms, a large effect size. That's why we do so many resistance training studies with untrained people, because they grow muscle more quickly for the most part. I mean, there's some neurological effects that account for the strength, but you can, you know, you're going to put on muscle faster in someone in their first year than in their 10th year of training.
Sure.
So you look at women, they've given women steroids, all sorts of steroids for all sorts of things, like, you know, bone health and treating breast cancer, et cetera, et cetera. But you look at women who are using gear, and the changes in them, of course, the quote unquote side effects, which is a word that it came up this weekend at Swiss, actually. Like, is that really side effects, or they're just unwanted effects?
Yeah.
They're things that the drugs do that we don't want, but they're not necessarily on the side. They could be the primary effect, to be honest. It's just something you don't like. But women are going to experience so much more. And if you look at how that can impact not only, like, you know, things we consider like the secondary sexual characteristics in some women at even smaller doses, but sex drive, you know, sex drive is renowned for just going sky high in women.
Yeah.
You know, when they start. So then that's obviously a psychological phenomenon, you know, to some degree.
You know, and even beyond the drugs themselves, looking at, you know, a lot of us are using underground labs, and, you know, you mentioned Dave Crossland a little while ago. Another thing he came up against was heavy metal toxicity. And I can only imagine, on top of this now, what is it going to do to have, you know, heavy metals poisoning us. You mentioned Alzheimer's. I mean, I could see there being, I mean, that adds, it's a whole other topic really, but I mean, not only do we have to worry about the steroids changing our moods themselves, but I have to feel heavy metals could play a role as well.
Yeah, there's all the issues, you know, with your source and illicit, you know, everything from getting abscesses to heavy metal poisoning. Did you have some blood work with, so you having like some cadmium or arsenic problems or something like that?
I can't remember what they were. I think there was, I think they found, what was it? I can't remember, but there are three heavy metals that they found, and they found them in pretty decent levels, pretty decent amounts. And this was when he was doing Under Construction 2, and he was running a lot of gear. You know, they so whatever we would see in small amounts, I believe mercury was one of them, aluminum maybe was another. And I have to think any of those things in high volumes is not going to be good, you know?
No, no, not at all. That's part of that, you know, that toxicity.
Yeah.
Issue too. Like that's, you know, that fits in there a little bit. You have this sort of inverted U relationship. More is not better. More can just be more, and it could be more toxicity and more side effects and less growth. Yeah. So yeah, there's some data for you.
All right. You mind if I move forward to the next one?
Yeah, go for it, man.
All right. This is
so much moving faster today, right?
Yes. Well, hey, you had a bunch of stuff to share on that, and it's good information, and so I don't want to cut you short on anything.
It's all good.
And it's not as if you were just going on and on. They were all unique details, so it is what it is. This is from Put Down the Phone And. He says, and what? Put down the phone and write us a message.
Oh, yeah.
I think write us a message. That's what he did. And then hopefully he trained after that. And he says, I'm a huge fan of the shows. Keep up the great work, guys. Thank you. He says, anyway, I have kind of a complicated question. He brought it to the right place that you can hopefully shed some light on. You got complicated questions. Dr. Scott has complicated answers. I posted this question for multiple shows. I know Dr. Scott has a vast knowledge on pituitary hormones and their interconnectedness. Here's a little background info. 21 years old and have a pituitary condition that has resulted in prescription TRT and thyroid replacement. Since fixing those two hormones, I feel much better and I am gaining muscle much easier. However, blood tests, IGF and serum GH, indicate that my low growth hormone, which has been known, which we all know is another pituitary related hormone, is on the border of the low end of the normal range and below range. These levels are especially low considering my age. My doctor is not willing to put me on replacement growth. I have tried MK677 and only got slightly improved blood growth hormone levels. My fasting glucose levels consistently test in the mid-60s, even on MK, so the health concern is not really an issue for me when it comes to considering growth. I have aspirations of competing in classic physique and bodybuilding and want to make sure I am setting myself up for success in every way possible. Do y'all have any, he said y'all, I wanted to make sure I said that correctly. Do y'all have any suggestions about what to do regarding my low growth hormone levels? I'm a pre-med student and work as a trainer, so I probably can't afford farm grade GH. Generic GH, different peptides, new doctor, or am I just overthinking all of this like I do everything else? I'm also wondering if what you think about that. I'm also wondering if you all think that growth would ruin my physique as I intend to compete in classic. I have heard mixed things about this. Physique pictures are below and also show what 2 years of TRT and thyroid coupled with proper dieting and training have yielded. Still have a long way to go, though. Thanks again for all the great content. And yeah, he looks good, Scott. I know you've got all our questions copied in your own format, but he's made some good progress. He's developing some good muscle, and he's got a nice back. Looks like good arms, and definitely he's got some thick quads going on.
Yeah, I saw the pics. He looks pretty lean there too. You know, he's not out of shape. I don't know where he was, you know, as far as pre-contest or peak of his off season.
Yeah.
Had those done, but so there's a lot here. Doctor's not prescribing, won't give him the growth hormone. He's not clinically or pathologically low. He wasn't outside the range.
Yeah.
So the thing is, growth hormone's highly pulsatile in its release. So the range is huge. You can sometimes you'll find like reference ranges are like at zero, like really, really low. I've seen that before. That's obviously you don't want to have no growth hormone, but you can find like tenfold ranges sometimes in over the course of a day.
Yeah.
In terms of peak. So there's that. I can't tell from those pictures. I don't know, maybe you have there's something you can use to pick up perspective or aspect on that I didn't see, but he doesn't look like he's short. He doesn't look like he's got any like dwarfism types of,
I would say no.
Yeah. So he's probably not if you were a growth hormone deficient dwarf, like literally, like there's other causes of growth of dwarfism, but then he would be really short. So he's probably not growth hormone deficient.
He's holding his phone in the picture, and it looks like an average size phone in an average size hand. It doesn't look like a giant phone or like a tablet. If it looked like a tablet, but it was actually the iPhone, then that might have been a clue.
Maybe it's a Zoolander phone, and he's actually his acromegaly.
Maybe that's it.
Yeah, so he's like, we can't quite tell, but I mean, the doctor's thinking, okay, your growth hormone's in normal range.
Get out of my office. Yeah.
Yeah, you're not a dwarf. But he didn't say, it's so helpful. It's funny because he's like, I have a vast knowledge of pituitary hormones, so he proclaims. And I don't know if that's absolutely accurate. I just kind of know some of the basics there, but it would be nice to know what pituitary condition he has. Because he's been given both TRT and thyroid replacement. So he's probably, he probably has hypogonadotrophic hypogonadism. So his LH, maybe his FSH as well, are low. And his TSH is probably low. So he may have, like, there's something you can give, like panhypopituitarism, where you've got just sort of a generalized, underdeveloped pituitary. Sometimes you can even see this with a brain scan, and just there's not many cells there. Just the pituitary isn't really developed, and you have a little growth hormone. And those people, I had a client once who was, he looked more like a what I think technically would be a midget. Like, he's just short and small.
Yeah,
and have dwarf like features, but he was definitely short. He was like maybe 5 feet tall, full grown. So. He had a brother that was a foot taller than him, something like that. So anyway, and he had pan hypopituitarism. So I don't know about that. The IGF-1 could be low from nutritional status. If he's dieting down, that would be low. Also, if the MK677, it's hard to know just with one blood draw, you know, what happened there. But if that didn't work well, if he does have like a little bit of a hypo-responsive pituitary, and using MK677 or another ghrelin agonist or MOD-GRF-129, which is a growth hormone releasing hormone, it's a modified version of a portion of that hormone. It might not do anything for him. He might not get anything from that because if he's got an undeveloped pituitary, which he may or may not have. So there's that. I'm kind of poking holes in his theorem here. And then there's also the fact that he's pretty lean. Not that he would, you know, so he doesn't have like, it's not like he has this issue that I can tell, at least from those pictures, where he can't get lean or he's just, you know, he's got a lot of body fat. There's some evidence that like having lower growth hormone tends to mean you have like a higher BMI or a larger waist to hip ratio in guys. So like you're a little more body fat.
Yeah.
It seems like he's got that, you know, cause that's what growth hormone does to a certain degree. It's very lipolytic. That's, you know, it's fat loss hormone for sure. So, I don't think there's any need for growth hormone. Not that he you know, per se. It's not like he's got like this, a replacement need that figure out just guessing at it. I don't think growth hormone would ruin his physique, but, you know, he's concerned about a GH gut or a roid gut or what have you. That's a whole other topic, but,
I feel like, I mean, the likelihood of him getting that with, you know, just a couple units a day, 2-3 units, I think is probably
no way.
Yeah. Less likely.
Not going to happen. I mean, just from, not that I'm saying he should or shouldn't do this, but it would be interesting to see, you know, what happened if he were to try some,
if
he do it, but, he doesn't have any, like, it's not like he's got like everything else in place. And like, there's just no way he's going to be able to do well without GH that I can see.
Yeah, he's made a lot of progress. Comparative to like society in general, most people will never see what he's done. You know, they'll never achieve that, you know?
Yeah. No, he looks good. Yeah. Looking at the pictures again here. Yeah, I see the phone there now. Yeah.
Yeah.
His watch looks normal sized.
Yes.
I don't see any giants behind him suggesting he's a small person.
Right.
Oh, a little person. So I don't know. I think he's good, but it makes sense given here's the thing is that, you know what? It's, I hate to see it when like, he's got a doctor who won't give him a diagnosis. Like what is actually going on with this pituitary? He's got replacing, you know, some major hormonal axes with the TRT and the thyroid. So like, what else is going on? Like, you can do growth hormone response tests. You know, that can be tested by an endocrinologist to see if, you know, he's sort of hyporesponsive, and he might do that. You know, that would be, he actually asked, should I get a new doctor? And I'm like, why not? Like, if his insurance covers it and he thinks there might be something going on there, I might try that.
Yeah.
Go see another doctor. You know, if you used, I don't know, doctors sometimes prescribe stuff. I didn't know that you can do off label prescriptions, but you know, the thing that would be interesting is like, if you use like, what is called CGC 1295 with DAC with DAC,
yeah,
which is the long acting form of the, MOD GRF-129. And that increases, growth hormone output, basically sort of elevates everything. You still have the normal pulsatility, it elevates everything for several days. And, that would then, you'd think that would cause an increase in IGF-1.
Yeah, you would think so.
Yeah, I mean, if he started using MK677, he might not have seen an elevation in growth hormone just at the time that he measured it from one dose. I don't know how he measured that. Like, he didn't give us any of the details. But if he used that, you'd typically see, we talked about this on the show before, something like a 60 to 80% increase in IGF-1. That's even with the down regulation that you see in the growth hormone release from MK677, that's pretty substantial. You still have a persistent, prolonged elevation of IGF-1, you know, over the course of months. Yeah. So, I mean, he could use, in this case, he could use the IGF-1 to see whether he's getting an effect from the MK677, and that would be diagnostic. Mm. So that's purely physiological information, not prescriptive.
Yeah.
But that like kind of gets at, you know, how he could kind of unravel the physiological puzzle that he's been left with.
Yeah, that makes sense.
Yeah.
Do you want to try to get to one more question here?
Yeah, sure.
All right. Which one did we have next, Scott? Were we going to do the one on DHT, it looked like?
Masteron and Drostanolone. Yeah.
Okay. Here we go. Hey guys, this is from Longstrand One. He's asked a lot of questions on the shows. Thanks, man. We appreciate it. And he's always got some good stuff. Wonder if you could talk a little bit, your thoughts on Masteron pre-contest in conjunction with Tren Ace. Heard Dave Palumbo talking about it relatively recently, saying it is derived from DHT, not having the properties of DHT, such as hair loss, acne, etc.
Okay, so I haven't heard that, whatever Dave actually said about that. So I don't want to create a straw man argument on Dave's behalf.
Yeah.
without having heard what he said. Yeah, Drostanolone is 5-alpha reduced, so that you can then sort of call it a DHT derivative, so it's not going to be aromatizable. It actually, so it's an interesting compound. It does seem to increase sex drive in a lot of guys. Guys will use it kind of for that purpose even.
Yeah.
So, and that's kind of an androgenic type of action. The side effects, and this goes back to actually what we kind of talked about with the brain. So the DHT, issues with DHT in like the scalp and in the skin, prostate, have to do with the person's genetics as far as how much testosterone that can be 5-alpha reduced to DHT. Of course, there's an issue with nandrolone we talked about before. That's another side topic, so keep that in mind. But in particular, the DHT is more androgenic, and it affects those tissues because of the tissue conversion locally of testosterone to DHT.
Yeah.
So Masteron is already 5-alpha reduced. I think it's got 2 methyl groups on it, which tends to make it more anabolic in general. When you inject whatever 100 milligrams of Masteron, that making its way throughout the body to the androgen receptors all over the body is different than, let's say, 100 milligrams of testosterone that then makes its way through the body and then is 5-alpha reduced locally to DHT. Hmm. I don't know. I haven't found a relative binding affinity, which doesn't tell us everything, but it tells us something of Masteron compared to DHT.
Yeah.
So, like as we said in the context with orals, how tightly something binds to the androgen receptor doesn't necessarily tell you how well it or what it's going to do in terms of hair loss. Actually, let me look up something here. This will just take a second. I think I have this.
All right.
And find it on my computer.
I find I respond really well to Masteron. It's I consider that my go-to compound for looking hard. It gives me a good look, and I get low side effects from it. Everything just seems like a benefit when I use it. So it's for me, that's one of the good ones. I've always been a fan. If I were to say, and you could tell I'm filling right now, by the way, as you look up your information.
Yeah,
I would say that if I were to do a cut cycle and I could choose like one hardening compound, that would be the one I'd pick.
Mm-hmm. Well, it inhibits the aromatase enzyme, so it's got that action going on.
Okay.
I've actually found some data that suggests it doesn't actually bind to the estrogen receptor.
Huh.
Its usefulness, for instance, with treating breast cancer was probably by preventing estrogen formation as opposed to blocking its binding. But I was looking up, I wanted to see in one of these studies where they actually have the binding affinities of DHT in this case is it's in rabbit, actually to SHBG, but there's a comparison of DHT with tinazolol, Winstrol, which is 5-alpha reduced. And there is basically like 100-fold difference in the extent to which DHT binds SHBG versus Winstrol. And then looking this up here, and a 4-fold difference in terms of how much DHT binds the androgen receptor in at least in rat muscle compared to human muscle. So that's comparing Winstrol, which tends to be harsh on the hair, versus DHT. No one's injecting DHT. Winstrol is not really binding as I said, a lot of these orals aren't binding the androgen receptor very tightly at all.
Yeah.
Especially compared to like testosterone, which binds the androgen receptor like 10 times more than Winstrol does.
Okay.
At least in rat muscle. So just being 5-alpha reduced like Winstrol is compared to DHT doesn't tell you that it necessarily, just as we talked about in the context with nandrolone, how androgenic it's going to be. it's more a function of the tissue conversion of testosterone to DHT that makes testosterone, and then thus the 5-alpha reduced version, the DHT, the culprit as far as hair loss and that kind of stuff goes.
Yeah.
I don't know with drostanolone. I haven't found direct comparison of binding affinity with those two. And again, binding affinity doesn't tell you everything either as to what it's actually going to do. So with Mastron, you've got the anti-aromatase actions. You've got the methylation, which tends to make it more anabolic than DHT would be because of that, by virtue of that. So that means you would probably use less. You're going to get a bigger anabolic versus androgenic bang for your buck, so to speak, with the extent of that androgenic component being less, it seems like, at least for many people. But how many people do okay with Winstrol, and how many people, some people lose, have hair loss?
Yeah.
Some have no issues. Like I heard our friend Jordan mention this. Someone asked him, I can't remember where it was recently, but he's a perfect person who's totally open on how much he uses and what he uses. Mm-hmm. And he has no hair loss at all. He thinks he gets it from his dad.
Yeah.
Who's got solid hairline. He's got a totally solid hairline. So there's really complex genetics involved with what's going on as far as hair loss goes.
Yeah.
So you've got a different compound in Mastron because of the estrogen actions, the anabolic actions, the fact that it's already 5-alpha reduced, and not knowing to what extent that actually is creating an androgenic action. That it's like you're comparing apples and oranges almost when you try to like compare it to DHT in and of itself, which no one uses anyway.
Yeah. So if it's already 5-alpha reduced, that means using like a blocker would not help in any way whatsoever, then.
Exactly. Like, okay. It's already there.
Yeah.
It's so, like trying to close the door and say, stay outside when someone's already inside.
Yeah.
It's
yeah.
Like, it's like, sorry, it's already 5-alpha reduced. Using a 5-alpha reducer, 5-alpha reductase inhibitor will not change that fact.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That makes total sense.
Yeah. But the interesting thing I did find, I dug into this one a little bit. There's a study, they were treating a breast carcinoma in women, and they compared, drostanolone, propionate, with nandrolone, decanoate. So different esters, so there's some issues there. But they found virilization in both women, in both groups of women, using nandrolone and Mastron. A little bit higher. Let's see if I could find the, hold on just a sec, I could find the abstract. It was like literally like 80 versus 70% or something like that, or maybe close to 90 versus 70%. I'll find it here, but there was virilization in both groups. So it can virilize. And again, actually I didn't think of this at the time, but this is another example of what I was saying, with women being sort of a good experimental model. Here it is. This is, virilization was produced in 78% of patients who received nandrolone and 85% of those treated with drostanolone propionate.
So higher.
That's basically, but it's 78 versus 85. It's basically, that's 8 out of 10, 8 to 9 out of 10 in both groups.
Okay.
Yeah. So virilization appeared earlier with drostanolone propionate, which might make sense given it's a shorter acting ester. I don't have the full paper. I didn't buy it. It was $40, I think. I don't know if actually I could buy it, but I was able to dig up the abstract.
Yeah.
So to give us at least that little tidbit. It does virilize.
Yeah.
So that's the androgenic actions.
I had no idea, and I had no idea that nandrolone was so strong for virilization either.
Yeah, these are women.
Yeah.
I probably should go get this paper. I literally just found this today because I thought this would be a cool one to dig into. It doesn't even list the dose here in the abstract.
Okay.
But again, women. So there's obviously it's not only just, it's not like women are just men lacking testosterone. There's also, going to be some other differences potentially in metabolism of the gear too. So, and I don't even know what aspects of virilization they were examining.
Yeah.
Were they looking at just hair growth? Or I mean, there's all sorts of things they could have been documenting. So this was a study from 1976. This is the kind of thing. They're not going to do this one again. They won't be trying to replicate these data. Mm. I don't think. Yeah. So, and there's probably some variability. There were some people who had no virilization. Some of the women had zilch.
Yeah.
You know? And one of the things that, you know, sort of empirically you kind of see with guys that do really well, that grow really well, this goes back to that inverted U phenomenon, is that they don't experience a lot of side effects. Maybe because they're really responsive and they don't need to use very much, so they don't get side effects. But they also, not always, this isn't always the case. There's a guy I'm thinking of right now, I won't name, who seems to experience very little side effects, but he also experiences very little effects. Mm. He's kind of a non-responder, but he also has a hardy system that, you know, seems to like handle the toxicity really well.
Yeah.
But yeah, so that, like, you know, you could have said that, you know, 15% versus 22% of the women did not experience virilization. Mm. So only 7% difference there. It's not much, really.
God, no, not at all, really.
Yeah.
But interesting. Well, that's all our questions for the day, Scott.
I think that's it, my man.
We got through them all. We've got a couple more pages, guys, but we are moving through these a little quicker. So definitely, if you want to take part in the show, we would love to have you. Please go over, as I mentioned, forum.advicesradio.com. And in the bodybuilding section, there is a Muscle Minds thread. So, Scott, we are recording this early this week. Do you train on the weekends?
I'm going to train today.
Yeah?
It depends on how the week falls. I've been traveling around so much.
Yeah.
Yeah, everything's just kind of mixed up. But I like to train on Sundays, actually. But I've got that, as we mentioned, I got the house issue. So I'm going to have to be stuck here at the house for the next 2 days. So I'm definitely going to train today.
Mm, excellent. That's a good plan. I'm doing, yep. I've committed to doing, splitting things up further. So I'm doing I'll call it a push pull leg day now, and then one day off, and then maybe more days off through the week if I need, but just basically push pull leg repeat is the plan.
Oh, so a 3-way split,
yep.
Training like 6 days a week.
It depends. I may take the train 3, take a day off, train 2, gotcha. Take a day off. And just when I pick back up, I'll train whatever I was training next, basically.
Yeah, that's smart. That's a really good way to auto. As long as you can kind of keep yourself from saying, oh, man, I feel like I have to train today. And you can take those days off when you really need them. That's a brilliant split.
I'm just trying to, you know, I've done well at splitting chest up this way. It's been a fun experiment learning to split my back up like this, because I'm used to my grueling, what used to be almost 3-hour workouts with Shelby sometimes. And he tailored that back. Now they're more like an hour and, you know, under 2 hours, under 2 hour workout easy. Well, you know, there's a lot of warm ups in there too and stuff. That's the first 25 minutes. But getting the intensity I want out of back and then stopping. That's the part, trying to get everything I can out of the workout, and not trying to, like, you know, pyramid up my intensity through it, but just to be able to get to 10, you know, immediately in the first set and, walk away feeling pretty beat up from that workout. I'm still learning how to do that right now for back.
Yeah. Are you using a logbook?
No, I'm not using a logbook because I'm not doing the same exercises every time yet. But I'm starting to pick them up, and I do know what I'm doing weight wise on a couple of particular movements that I've been using every time. And I think I'm going to do a pull up one day and a pull down the next day. So I think I'm always going to have those two things in. One day is a pull up day and the next day is a pull down day. And then a row. I've kind of been throwing in like a third thing just to kind of volumize the muscle, you know, at the end where I can do like a little bit of higher reps. Cause it feels like I need that. I feel like I need to go into higher reps. But it's basically, I'm just trying to get in and punish the muscle as best I can and then get out. So it's not an official logbook type thing yet, but I'm working my way there, I guess is what I should say.
So your conversation with Dusty Hanshaw did not convince you that the logbook is the way to go.
No, well, you know what? I feel an exercise, Scott, and I want to do what seems to be feeling right that day. And it's like, my problem with the logbook is it's too rigorous for me to decide that this is what I'm going to do. I might be able to do a logbook with something like the pull down or the pull up, but sometimes I want to do a seated row with a cable. Sometimes I want to do a T-bar row. Sometimes I want to do a barbell row. Sometimes I want to do a dumbbell row. And I have all these different exercises. Sometimes my lower back hurts, so then I use a machine row. And it's hard for me to keep track of all these different exercises is what it comes down to for me. And then I just like lose focus on, I lose track. Cause it's like, well, I haven't done a seated cable row in 3 weeks type thing.
Mm-hmm.
And so coming back to it now, that's really been the holdup. Cause I really tried to do the logbook before, and that's what I ran into. I don't know.
Yeah, no, I'm going to phrase it just that. Imagine if you derived immense pleasure out of looking in the logbook and just taking it to task, making it your bitch.
Yeah.
And you really dug that, then you probably would just use a logbook because it'd be really fun for you.
That's a good point. Yeah, that is true.
Right. So it's you know, you have to train the way that makes it fun. And I mean, when it comes down to it, you do what you love, you know, you do what you like. And yeah, that's where we are. And I'm not calling the pot calling the kettle black. I am definitely a creature of immediate gratification myself too. But that's why I have like in fortitude training, not to like try to make it all about me, but
no,
I've got the regular loading sets where you do rotate through and you're constrained to those, unless of course, you know, your back's killing you and it's just a stupid move to try to push it through an exercise that's going to be injurious. But you use a an exercise pool, a muscle round pool. So people, I can go back and just the way I've got my logbook set up, I can scan back until I find that exercise really rapidly. Cause I use an index card system that's pretty easy. But I've suggested a lot of people just like set up a pool, like at the back of your logbook, you have a big binder type thing or a notebook, and you just like have back. Yeah. You just write down, like for you, you'd write down like PRs for those exercises. So you might have like 10 or 12 exercises. You just write one on each line, like, you know, dumbbell row, whatever, you know, bent over barbell row, and you write, you know, 315 by 12.
Yeah.
And put the date. And then like next time, like friggin' 2 months later, you could be, I'm going to do fucking barbell rows today.
Yeah.
It's going to be a bitch. And you just flip back to the pool, you flip back to that page. And you just scan, like, there it is, barbell row. I see when I did that back in August 9th. All right, I got to beat 315 by 12. And you just do it.
Yeah.
Put it there.
Yeah, I could see that. There's so many variables for me, though, because I've honestly tried it, and I end up with, like, this started log of all sorts of different stuff. And then, you know, my back hurts. And so it's like, well, now I'm going to have to go for higher reps. And now what do? I have a log for barbell rows when my back hurts and when it doesn't. You know what I mean? It's like, it just becomes too overwhelming. It really does for me.
That's funny. It's just, I'm just laughing because I logbook, you know, I've been logbooking for like decades now, you know, as is Dusty, as does Jordan.
Yeah.
You know, as do so many other people. And you could easily do that. I mean, I'm not trying to pick on you, but you could easily, then you have a light and a heavy day. You just write down barbell rows, you know, low back safe, you know, or whatever. And you do 2 1/4 and you got 23. So like the next time you say, I feel like a light day on barbell rows. And you just read up until you see barbell rows. Takes you all of like probably 12, 15 seconds, like nothing in the grand scheme, especially if you're doing 2 hour back workouts or whatever.
Yeah. Well, I'm not doing 2 hours anymore. Now it's about 50 minutes somewhere in there.
Long, long ago, I used to tell people, like, and I did this for years. I would just like have, and I mentioned this on the podcast too, is have like a core group of exercises, like literally, like, and you have some of this in your head, but like, you know, maybe 12 or 15 that you come back to, that you use as your marker. So maybe just like once every other week, you know, given whatever exercises you're doing, you go back. Because we're creatures of habit. There probably are some exercises that you do at least once a month.
Absolutely.
Yeah, so you go back to those ones that you know you've constantly, consistently been doing because they work for you. You like how they feel, and you just log those, and that's it. So you've got like literally the dirty dozen logbook exercises, and you write those down. So you're probably logging like three things a week or something like that.
I could log that. Yeah.
Yeah.
And that's what I'm thinking is if getting into logging, I could log that.
And then, yeah. So then you look back, say, okay, like 2 years ago, I was doing 315 for 12 and now I'm doing 315 for 13 and my back's not any better. Or conversely, of course, shit, like 275, I was only able to get eight times and now I'm getting now I'm getting 365 for eight.
Yeah. Yeah.
No one. Yeah. This is badass. This is awesome. I'm super happy and I can see that in my back. This is great. So that's the proof's in the pudding. Like that logbook will speak the truth to you.
Yeah. The other thing was, if I do, say I do barbell rows first and then the next time I do, pull downs first, I'm not going to get as much on a second or third exercise as I am the first time I do it. So it's all these things play into it. And that's what confuses me.
That's
yeah.
Then you say, you know, I will note those things too. You know, that's why I keep.
I bet you do.
but it's actually my workout. I can tell, you know.
Yeah.
Or you could just make a note like third exercise. But then who gives a rat's ass? If you're doing barbell rows every month and you do them let's say January, you do it the first exercise and February the second and March the third, and you come back and it's April and you do it the first exercise again and you go up by five reps, that's good.
Yeah. Maybe that's just my ability to take good notes because it would it's so confusing if I feel okay, if I don't feel okay, if I'm doing it first, if I'm doing it second, it gets confusing to me, honestly, because I've given it an effort but I have gotten lost. And then I end up with all these records of ones and twos, different exercises I've done once or twice. And then I come back to it. I'm like, well, like the variables are all different today. I can't really use that. And then I'm getting overwhelmed talking about it.
I can tell. And that's the mindset that does not go with logbooking. It's not about, okay, let's see. I rated 5.5 minutes after my last you look at the logbook and you say, you're my fucking bitch, shut up. And then you kick it to ass. Then you dominate it into submission.
So it's a mindset. It's a mindset thing. That's what it is.
Like literally that's kind of, I mean, you might be like, okay, like, geez, I got fucking killed here. Like, what the hell happened? And then you look and say, well, shit, I just did deadlifts before my bent over rows. No wonder, like, you know.
Yeah.
But then you can also say, fuck it. I'm going to match the reps. I don't give a rat's ass about those. I'm still going to get 12 reps with 315 or whatever it may be. It's going to happen. And, like, you look at the logbook with a certain amount of respect but also disdain. It is your nemesis in that day. And, you know, give it whatever advantage. It's like, you know, you show up to play racquetball with somebody and, you know, he's got he's got something going on there. You know, he's got some trick up his sleeve, but you're like, I don't care what he does. I'm going to kick ass. He's going to get beaten. He's got some new sneakers on or he's got some brand new racket, you know, or he's got, you know, whatever it is, it doesn't matter. He's still getting his ass whooped. That's kind of the mentality that fits with logbooking. And I've seen this before. I've had clients, people I've seen on my discussion board who will go and they're like lost in this sea of overanalyzing detail.
That's what it is. That's what it is.
And it ultimately comes down to just looking, you know, and sometimes like your form's going to go to shit, you know, like because you get a little aggressive with it and you got to be careful. You got to have some sense of rhyme or reason. Like don't become just an idiot in how you lift trying to get more reps.
Yeah.
Even Dante would talk about, you need to go back and like reset your form sometimes and, you know, start doing squats deep into the hole if you gradually let your ass creep up over time to try to beat the logbook.
Yeah.
But it's something that, and it may or may not match your mentality. Like I listened to the interview with Dusty, and you know, he has a perfect mentality, the way his perspective is structured for the logbook. It's black and white. There's no ifs, ands, or buts about it. Either you beat the reps or you didn't. And that's kind of how it looks. It's like either I'm beating these reps and I'm gonna get better or I'm not. And so like what's set out in front of me, regardless of any minutia, in the long haul, whether it was the first, second, or third exercise, or I waited 3.5 or 4.5 or 5.5 minutes between exercises or whatever, yeah. If stuff doesn't go the right direction, then my physique's not going to go where I want it to. And that's all it comes down to. So
fair enough.
You have to, you just write it down, which feels like, you know, you're being anal retentive a little bit, but at the same time, you're not. You're just like, it's like target practice. You're putting up the dummy that you're about to beat in submission by writing down what you did, because that's what's going to get its butt whooped the next time you get in the gym and do that exercise.
Okay. Well, I get it. I've never heard anybody say that before.
Well, that's good.
Yeah.
I'm glad I wasn't like beating something in your head that you've heard a million times.
Well, maybe I need to hear it a million and one to hear it, to listen.
There you go. That's the attitude.
All right. Well, let's get out of here for another episode of Muscle Minds with Dr. Scott Stevenson. I'm Scott McNally. Guys, we will see you next time.
Thanks, guys. See you next time.
Voices Radio Network.